The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
So Jackie, as she said, she's handing out, I guess, high holiday tickets for here at AU, right?
Yes, I'm passing around something. If you're interested in the Yom Kippur Seder, if you can just put $5 in there now, and if not, then I'll let me know that you have her, if you have her, have it paid next to your name, and I'll just collect the money from you later.
Right.
Student tickets for services at American University. You know what, I'm just going to leave these back here. AU Hillel does ask for a donation of whatever you can give. You can't give really nothing of the money. So we did this last year, and it was a real success, and a lot of people requested for me to do it again this year. This is Rabbi Edelstein of Mesora, D.C., brilliant Jewish scholar.
Oh, please.
Fascinating.
Jewish is accurate. That's
And I wanted to bring you back this year and to start like a lecture series about Jewish law. And I know he's flexible and unflexible for topics that you guys are interested in, anything you've learned about before and you want to delve into deeper, or something that totally new and you haven't learned about. And I believe he's also open to, if you have personal questions, and he loves teaching, and he's an amazing teacher, so he's available to you for that. So I'm just going to turn it over to you, Rabbi Edelstein. And the topic of today's discussion is, what is the Talmud investigating sources of Jewish law?
Thank you, Jackie. It's so great to be back here. Again, let me just say, Rabbi Edelstein's my name. And I work for an organization called Mesora DC. Basically, it's a fairly recent, I guess you'd call it, startup Jewish education and outreach organization in DC. I spend about half my time doing classes at the universities, mostly GW and AU, and also the other half of my time working with young professionals. And I teach a lot of the classes at the Sixth and I Historic Synagogue, which is a very beautiful facility that y'all should go to just to visit, regardless if it's for a class or one of our programs, but it's on the corner of Sixth and I Street. It's this remarkably beautiful, restored historic synagogue. Hey, how you doing? And so I teach a lot of classes there as well. I'm not going to, you can go to our website, www.mesoradc.org, that's MesoraHDC.org, but even better, to help you remember, I'm going to hand out, with Jackie's permission, a card about, well, it's kind of a general informational card, but also featuring, we do monthly Shabbat dinners for young professionals and grad students down at the Sixth and I Synagogue. We have a service, it's called a Kalbach service, formed around the melodies of Shlomo Kalbach, a great Jewish songwriter and singer, and then a Shabbat dinner, and we get usually between 75 and 100 people, in their 20s, some in their 30s. But anyway, here's a card about that program. You can take one, please, and pass it on. It has my email. It has the website address on there as well. And closer to home, we are having on both days of Rosh Hashanah a Rosh Hashanah service at the same place, the Sixth and I Synagogue, starting at 10:30 in the morning. Now, we have these incredibly cute and clever cards. I didn't design them, but I don't have enough of them to give out to everybody. See, it says, your shofar has arrived. Very, very cute, huh? And Mesora DC, my organization, is the license plate. But I did make a copy, a rather bland Xerox copy of the card, so you can all take one in case you don't have plans for Rosh Hashanah. We're offering a service both days of Rosh Hashanah at 10:30, and it's going to be a little bit different. It will be a service, but there will also be concurrent little mini classes. So you want to take a break from the service and learn more in depth about the high holidays or the shofar or the symbolism or whatever, you can take a break from the actual service and go hear a little mini class. So if you don't mind, thanks, Mike. Take one of those. I'll save the pretty cards. Hi there. How you doing?
Good.
What's your name? You look familiar. Did we meet last year?
Alan, yeah.
Alan, yeah. Good to see you.
Graduated.
Oh, great. Okay.
Take it away from
Alan. Okay, great. Grant, please, like Jackie said, feel more than, you know, more than free. That sounds good. Feel free to email me if you want to, you know, talk more about anything, explore anything with ideas for future discussions. I'm very lucky because I really don't have one office. Every Starbucks in the city is my office. for every coffee place, and that's really pretty true. So I'm always meeting people, students and professionals, for coffee to talk about different things, study together, one-on-one, whatever. So I'm open to all those kind of things. Okay. So maybe we'll start. And somewhere there's a sheet. If you haven't signed in, I'd love it if you do so I can, like, you know, learn people's names, hopefully get to know people around here. There's the sign-in sheet. Oops. Okay, so I have to, as a little introduction to the introduction, you know how it's just human nature, whenever you listen to something or someone for a while, you begin to sound like them. That's an obvious point. In fact, I remember, well, whatever, it goes whether it's one's spiritual teacher, one's rabbi, one's wife, one's husband, right? I've been married 11 years. I'm sure I have many mannerisms with my wife. But the last 2 weeks, as many Americans have, probably many law students too, I've been pretty transfixed by the Senate Judiciary hearings of John Roberts. So I listened all week. It was last week, I guess, or 2 weeks ago. But just today on the way here, I was listening again because everyone in the Senate Judiciary Committee is giving their final statement. So if I sound like I'm addressing a Judiciary Committee or like just it's because I've been listening to this and, you know, if you ask me a question, I say, well, I'm not prepared to answer that or whatever. I'm probably going to sound with, intonations of John Roberts or whatever. But the truth is I'm not just saying that, you know, as a cute introduction. Maybe you don't need me to tell you this, but I'll tell you to you anyway, and that is that so many of the, one of the reasons I found it interesting, of course, is that, you know, as someone who studies Jewish law, and Talmud is Jewish law, as we'll talk about, obviously a lot of the vocabulary and the categories, the conceptual categories that are discussed, that were discussed in those hearings, are very similar to Jewish law. Jewish law being a system of law, different in many ways, but similar in certain conceptual categories or whatever. So I found it really, really interesting, and you know, maybe even later today when we talk about precedent and stuff like that, which they talked about a lot, certainly those kind of issues come up in Jewish law as well. And so, how many people here listen to them or were interested? You're so busy, you might be so busy in law school you don't care about them, but like for me out in the regular world, it was so interesting. Anyone here listen to them at all? Couple of people, yeah. Did you find them interesting?
The hearings?
Yeah, the hearings, yeah.
Yeah, I do. You want specific answers, but
right. Right. I was just introducing just the way they were talking about the law and how law evolves or is shaped and the senators with their own.
They spoke more than him. There's some website that counted how many times one of the senators said I. And
Chuck Schumer, yeah, said like 17 in there, yeah. Yeah. But it was really interesting, actually, and it's not so much our topic tonight. Today, maybe it would be another time, but it's really something to think about. Can I close the door, Jackie? Is that okay, or should I not? Can I close the door? You want to leave it open?
Yeah.
Okay. Sort of like a little quirk. I like it closed. Okay. You know, it was like when they asked him, he kept saying that his value that drives him is the rule of law, and that he even sees the rule of law as the best guarantor of liberties or whatever. But the senators, some of the liberal Democratic senators mostly, were trying to get him to express his support for other values like equality, like civil rights or whatever. And it was just interesting. I mean, we're not going to analyze our time to the whole. We could analyze that discussion because the truth is, I'm not going to take a political stand here. That's not my place. But I think John Roberts believes basically in civil rights. I certainly think he believes in equality for women, of opportunity, whatever. But the vocabulary and the kind of angle intellectually from which they were approaching. Well, I don't know, their whole view of American life was very different. One was a legalistic approach, you call it his, you know, and it's something to think about maybe for a future class, Jackie, which would be like, you know, how much the relationship between Jewish law and values, other values in Judaism, right? The value of justice, the value of truth. I mean, are they synonymous with just Torah law, or is there some areas of where the value seems to conflict with the law? It could be an interesting topic to discuss. But anyway, I sent to Jackie a list of possible topics for today, and I have to say, and it just shows interest in her own mind and her interest, but I was actually surprised what she chose. Because I chose the first three suggestions I gave were like, you know, I don't remember what it was, death penalty in Jewish law, environmental issues in Jewish law, trendy, topical stuff. And then at the end, I said, well, yeah, maybe people want to hear. I really thought, it was at the end of the list because I thought no one would really want this. You know, what is the Talmud for people? What is Jewish law really is a better description of this class? What is, like, an overview of Jewish law? And I really didn't expect at all that Jackie would jump on that. And she emailed me back and said, I think that would be so fascinating to learn about. So I hope you all share that interest, because this will definitely be, if and when I'm confirmed and I come back, we would do very different kind of talks than today. Today will be, you know, other ones would be very topical and, you know, taking a dilemma or a controversy or something and looking at it in Jewish sources. But I was selected, or you selected for me to speak about, you know, kind of the sources of Jewish law. So that's what we're going to talk about today. So I'm going to hand out a couple things, first one at a time. But I'm just curious, how many people here attended Jewish day school? A few people in Jewish day. Oh, very good. Okay, so quite a few. Okay. So then a lot of the things I might be telling you are like, oh, I heard it before. Now, some of you may not have heard some of these things before, but I'm always very successful as a speaker when I set my bar very low. All I want to do today is just get you thinking about certain issues and a certain very, very general overview of what the Talmud is, what Jewish law is all about. And it's, you know, I was thinking as I came here, right, there's a whole law school. You guys and girls, you study law day and night for 3 years, or except when you're, you know, partying to relax, but you're studying day and night for, you know, and the truth is, to have any clear understanding of Jewish law, I mean, it's a 20-year process of studying in a yeshiva or in a Talmudical academy or research. I mean, there's no end to the scope of Jewish law. So, you know, I'll do my best to kind of sketch some very general outline of certain things here. But I start off that it's a very complicated topic. Even when we talk about what exactly is the content of what's called the Talmud, that itself is a very complicated topic. Meaning the categories of material in the Talmud and stuff. But okay, I'm going to start much before that. Did everyone get the outline? Okay. So actually, you see at the top of this thing, something that the title of the talk, not to confound everybody, but it says the Mishnah. We'll define some of the terms, but you can't understand what the Talmud is until you understand a work that came chronologically before there was ever something called the Talmud, and that was something called the Mishnah. But let's even start before that. Okay. One other point, which I think it's always fair to, you know, to say at the beginning, is that I'm going to be sharing with you and articulating what could fairly be called the traditional perspective on the issue of the Torah and of Jewish law. And that means traditional, coming from within the tradition itself. The sources we'll look at are all, you know, great rabbis and sages of the Talmud, either explaining Talmudic law or even the abbreviated history of these things. I'm not suggesting there are other ways you can approach the topic. I'm not suggesting that, you know, academic studies might yield certain insights, but I'm articulating the traditional view, which is certainly a good place to start in any case. Okay, so that's... So the traditional view is that the very word Torah... Well, actually, let me ask you, what's your name? I'm sorry, I don't mean to segue that.
I'm Melissa.
Melissa, what does the word Torah mean? You've heard of the word Torah.
I have.
Okay, what does it mean? Nice definition.
Okay,
you did good with that definition. Okay. What's contained in that text, Torah? What's the boundaries of that text? I'm not saying how many pages and how many words, but what does it mean, the Torah?
Great.
Okay, I'm glad. Okay, good. So she has one definition, a narrow definition in a sense. not narrow and cramped, like they're always calling John Roberts' view of civil rights. He's a cramped, narrow view of civil rights. You got a very, that's a good literal definition of a Torah. It's a scroll with words on it. That's a good place to start. You know why? Because what's unique, or what's strange maybe, everyone's here has seen a Torah scroll, right? Probably. What does a Torah scroll lack when you read the writing in the Torah scroll?
Vowels.
It lacks vowels. What else does it lack?
Punctuation.
Punctuation. That's correct. There are certain sections, something like paragraphs sometimes, but whatever. No vowels, no punctuation. Keep that fact in your mind for a couple of minutes. We'll refer back to it. But that's... Melissa gave us a nice little definition of Torah. Let me go back one more time. The Torah scroll that Melissa described, where does it start, where does it end? What's inside the Torah scroll?
Five books of Moses.
Good, a lot. Okay, very good. We're starting basic. That's okay. Basics are important. Five books of Moses. So that constitutes the Torah.
Part of it.
Ah, okay. What do you mean part of it? Okay, so Alan, good, he's not a plant, but he's introducing something very important, and that is really the topic of today's class, is not the Torah. Because really, anyway, the truth is there are many other definitions, we can make that an expansive definition, what Torah includes. Moses had a scroll. Alan, right, said,
Alan.
Alan said five books of Moses, that's what the scroll contains, that's definitely true. And then I pressed him, and he said that's called the written Torah. A Torah, Torah means instruction. It's related to the word moreh, like if you had in Hebrew school, a moreh, a morah, hora'a. Torah is instruction, and that scroll represents, or is, the Torah shebiktav, an instruction that was written down. Okay? Very good. But what's the other Torah, Alan? There's another Torah.
The oral Torah.
The oral Torah. Okay, you're answering all the good questions today. Good. What's the oral Torah? How many of you have heard of the idea of an oral Torah? Raise your hand. How many of you have never heard of such a concept of the oral Torah? Okay. Some people didn't want to vote. That's okay. You can abstain. Okay. Well, let's go back to the Torah scroll for a second. Let me ask somebody else about Len. Okay, that's true. That is a traditional way of compartmentalizing this huge body of Jewish learning that is called the general word Torah. There's an aspect or a section called Torah Shebiktav, the written Torah, the five books of Moses. And then there's the oral Torah. So what is the oral Torah? And what's its relationship to the written Torah? Michelle? Another bit right now. You got it? Thanks. Well, what's that? Okay, Len calls it a key to the... What's your name?
Brian.
Brian, what were you going to say?
I was going to say it's somewhat of an application of the written Torah, but not entirely. It definitely sounds on it somewhat separately.
Separately in subject, separately in...
In subject and content, I think it's reasonable to contend that it sort of handles some of the separate issues. It's not just... I mean, obviously the commentary is... It's not a commentary on the written Torah in the way the commentaries are... Further clarification of the oral Torah.
Okay.
You see the analogy I'm drawing, it's not that same way, but it's sort of expounding on it.
Expounding on it. Okay. Okay, good. We're going to keep going with these things for the whole class, talk about some of these things. But let's just go back for a second to the Torah scroll. It is a part of the oral Torah how to pronounce the words that are written in the Torah scroll. That's part of oral tradition. Where one word stops and one sentence stops and one sentence begins is part of an oral tradition. Now, of course, we have written chumashim. We have written books with a voweling system of a later date. But that's very important. The very words of this thing we call Torah have an ambiguous meaning or no coherent meaning at all without an oral tradition that expounds and sometimes defines and explains the very words. That comes up many, that's an important, very important point, actually, really. I'll give you an example, right? Just one example, right? Many of you people know, one of the beauties of the Hebrew language, Lashon HaKodesh, the Holy Tongue, as it's called, but one depending on the vowelization, you can have obviously radically different words with the same consonants. I guess that's true in other languages too. But, right, there's a commandment in the Torah, a verse in the Torah, that says, Lo sevashel gidi or gid bechet lamid beis imo, which literally means, don't boil a kid in the something of its mother. Why am I saying something? Because when you open the Torah scroll, there's a chet alamed abeis. But that can be pronounced chelev, fat, or chalav, milk. So it's a very different commandment. In fact, a totally dissimilar commandment if the commandment is not to boil a kid in the fat of its mother or not to boil a kid in the milk of its mother. Of course, we know, everyone probably knows, milk, meat, right. The traditional understanding of that verse is chalavimo, which means the milk of its mother. And that's, of course, the source in the written Torah of an idea of a separation between milk and meat in our diet, part of our dietary laws. But I just point that out to show that you can't even get to square one without relying on something just not written down. At least nowadays, of course, like I said, we have the vowels. But 1,000 years ago, 1,500 years ago, when you just had a Torah scroll, that idea that I just tried to articulate is mentioned in the Talmud itself. Very famous case. A story. Part of the Talmud, a very small part, but part of the Talmud consists of stories. Ethical stories, inspirational stories, deep philosophical ideas embedded in stories. One of the famous stories in the Talmud that many people have heard is a story where a potential convert comes to Hillel. Remember, Hillel was a very, very great rabbi, very important in the development of the oral law and of Judaism in general. And every college campus has a Hillel house, right? So Hillel was a very important man, great in learning, but also great in his personal qualities of humility and generosity. And a section of the Talmud dealing with the laws of Sabbath, Shabbat, certain tractate of the Talmud, tells many stories of Hillel's patience as a human being. One of the famous stories, which I'm not talking about now, but you've heard it, I'm sure, is a convert comes in and asks Hillel to teach him the whole Torah while standing on one foot, meaning boil down the Torah to me in its essence. Hillel's counterpart, Shammai, drives the man out of the study hall as if he's causing an affront to the honor of the Torah, whatever, why Shammai did that's a whole matter of discussion. But Hillel doesn't drive the man out. Hillel says, famously, what's hateful to you, don't do to your fellow man. That's the Torah. The rest is commentary. Now go and learn. Okay, that's often misquoted, but that's what he says to him. And of course, he was articulating the idea of love your neighbor as yourself, but in the negative form, what's hateful to your neighbor, don't do to it. What's hateful to you, don't do to your neighbor. Fine. But there's another story in the very same section about Hillel. Different story, but also about a potential convert. Potential convert comes to Hillel and says, teach me the Torah on the condition that I'm not going to accept the oral Torah, the rabbinical teachings that you Jews call the oral Torah. I'm not going to accept that, but I want to learn the written Torah. Fine. So Hillel says, fine, let's begin. Day one, we're learning the Aleph base. Aleph, Beit, Gimel, Dalet, Hey, he teaches him, or whatever. The next day, the convert comes in, I'm paraphrasing, and he says, let's review our lessons. Okay, the Aleph Beit goes, Dalet, Gimel, Beit, Hey, whatever. The proselyte says, potential proselyte says, I don't understand. Yesterday you told me Aleph Beit, Gimel, Dalet, Hey. Now Hillel said, more eloquently than me, but he said, you have to rely on me for the order of the Aleph Beit. Even the simplest building block of the Hebrew alphabet is based on an oral tradition. So I ask you to trust me, or whatever I'm paraphrasing, you should rely on me for the rest of the explication I'm going to give you about the Torah. In other words, it's all intertwined with a written Torah, but an explication and a supplementation with an oral tradition. That makes sense, sort of? That basic idea. Okay, now, a lot of questions, lots to talk about, and that's what we want to do here. I feel no compulsion to finish everything on this long outline. The written Torah itself, the five books of Moses, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, the five books of Moses itself, at many times within the words of that text, suggests or says things that would seem to suggest that there is more than one Torah. What do I mean? Well, I gave one example, but there are several examples. Verses like Leviticus 26:46. Someone want to read it to the beginning of the outline there. See it up, Mike. You see that? Want to read that verse? Leviticus 26.
These are the decrees, Kirkim, and the ordinances, Mishpatim, and the teachings, Toros.
Or Torot, Torot as the Sephardic, right?
That Hashem gave between himself and the children of Israel at Mount Sinai through Moshe.
Okay. Now, decrees, chukim. That's a word the Torah uses for a certain category of law, of mitzvot. Chukim, decrees. Mishpatim, it's another category of laws. And Torot, literally Torahs. Torahs. Now, true, the word Torah means teaching, but it's a very unusual construction. Torot, it sounds like there are two Torahs. What? There's only one Torah. The oral tradition, with Rashi, the great commentator, who brings from the oral tradition to elucidate the written text of the Torah, but it's an ancient teaching, says this is one of the hints or one of the places where the text of the written Torah refers to something beyond itself, two Torahs, one oral, one written, or I should say one written, one much larger body of learning, teaching called the oral Torah. Okay, and then Rashi goes on, or the sages go on to say the verse teaches that both were given to Moshe at Sinai. That's another traditional view. The idea that not only, and I know there's a lot to talk about, I know there are all different kinds of Jewish people, liberal, traditional, conservative, orthodox, different views on what the Torah is, I'm aware of that, but the traditional view, when I say traditional, meaning, you know, that all the Talmudic sages shared, and all the post-Talmudic codifiers of Jewish law shared, and was not real, well, not that there were individuals who challenged certain things over the centuries or had different views, Spinoza being one famous one, but by and large, until the 19th century, the overwhelming majority of the Jewish people shared the traditional view of the Torah, that what? The words of the written Torah were spoken by God to Moses at Mount Sinai, and not only the written words, but the elucidation of the written words as well. The right? In 40 days and 40 nights that traditionally we learn Moshe spent on Har Sinai, he learned not only the written words of what would become the Torah scroll that he would later write in his own lifetime, but the explanation of the laws in the Torah. Okay, that's the traditional view. Fine. But there are other places where, my point I wanted to make, there are other verses similar to that, where, you know, Exodus 24:12, which I didn't copy for you, you know, whatever, I wasn't going to give you every, I didn't want to overload you with things like that, but it's another example where the Torah does one of those, you know, weird phraseology here, and it says, the Lord said to Moses, ascend to me on the mountain. Ah, this is important. This is right after the actual public revelation of the Ten Commandments. Ascend to me in the mountain and remain there, and I shall give you the stone tablets and the teaching and the commandment that I have written. What's the redundancy? It's all one. Okay, and it is part of traditional Judaism to take it on faith that there's not a single extra word in the Torah that doesn't teach something. Each one of those represents a different part of this large body of knowledge that's being given to us as a responsibility to uphold. The stone tablets, the teaching, and the commandment. I forget now how Rashi or the sages explain each one, but one of those phrases means the oral law. I think the teaching. I think the tablets is the written law, as exemplified by Ten Commandments on the tablets. The teaching is the oral elucidation of the written law. Okay. Now, there's so much to talk about, and I'm open to questions, please. I'm not trying to, I don't want to lecture. I don't want to be a lecturer, really. But, like, there are many places in the written Torah, the five books of Moses, that make very little sense or are outright contradictions one place to the other without, or just plain ambiguous, unless one supposes, accepts the idea that there was an oral tradition going along with it. Of course, I know there are debates about that, but I mean, in different circles about, you know, like the Sadducees. It was a group earlier in Jewish history that accepted that God spoke the five books of Moses word for word, dictated to Moses. But the rabbinical interpretation, that was invented later. That was not. They were a sect of the Jewish people, the Sadducees, that accepted the written Torah as a divine document, not the oral law. Okay, but even the Sadducees and other groups like them then had a very hard time figuring out how to put into practice the written Torah. Let me give you one example. There are many, many examples. A lot of these are discussed in the Talmud itself, right? Show me where in the five books of Moses it describes how we slaughter an animal in a kosher way that we can, that a Jewish person can eat it. It doesn't. Moses says at one point, it's in Deuteronomy 12:21, and you shall, he's talking about, well, if I, let me be more precise, I forget now what's going on over there, but, right, the Jewish people, as is with a lot of Deuteronomy, Deuteronomy began its life, so to speak, a little bit differently than other books of the Torah. It was began as Moses' sermons to the Jewish people before they entered the land of Israel and before he died. Later, traditionally, we understand that God told them to take it down to form part of the Torah, but it started out as his, you know, closing statements, if you will, to the Jewish people. And he goes over, it's called often in rabbinical language Mishneh Torah, which means a repetition of the Torah itself, because the most inspiring parts of the Torah in a lot of ways are in Deuteronomy. Moshe is summoning up, you know, the essence of the Torah and reviewing a lot of it with him. But anyway, he's going in and talking about the idea of bringing sacrificial offerings to the temple, which will be in Jerusalem, and, you know, laws about that. But he says here, it's talking about whatever, an issue which we won't get into now. But what does it say there in 12:21? If the place where God, the Lord your God, will choose to place his name, oral tradition says that's Jerusalem, that's the temple that will stand in Jerusalem, if it will be very far from you, you may slaughter from your own cattle and your flocks, because in earlier periods of Jewish history, people couldn't actually eat meat unless it was a consecrated offering in the sanctuary or the tabernacle, whatever, that's not important now, but it says you may slaughter from your cattle and your flocks that the Lord has given you, as I have commanded you. You may slaughter as I have commanded you. Where in the rest of the five books of Moses is there a discussion of Moses commanding them as how to slaughter the animals? It's nowhere. Nowhere at all in the written Torah. That's one example of that even people who, whatever, will concede there must have been missing information that people had to go on, whatever. Another great example. One of the holiest and most beautiful mitzvot that traditionally men in Judaism don tefillin, phylacteries, in the morning, in the daylight hours. Okay? Women are exempt from the mitzvah, but that's another discussion. Tell me, Ari, show me, where does it describe how you make tefillin, as they're called, in the written Torah?
It doesn't.
Not at all.
It just says to the foot.
Yeah, it says something very elucidating, right? It says, you shall bind these words on your arm for a sign and make them totefot between your eyes. Ta-da! Clear as crystal, right? To make tefillin, what they're called. It's all of the laws, in fact, of the shaping and forming of tefillin. Remarkable consistency throughout. I think when they found remains from Masada or whatever, you know, Dead Sea Scrolls, tefillin look basically the same now as they did, whatever. All part of the oral law, what's called Halacha LaMoshe MiSinai, directly passed down from Moshe, the forming of tefillin. Now, there are many, many, many examples of that. All I want to say, and I'll summarize, and then we'll have questions or comments, but that's the idea that there's definitely, I just give you examples of, like, ambiguities or something, that's not the, you know, thing, information left out, but there are also outright contradictions, right? Sometimes, for instance, it'll say about the Jewish festivals, 6 days you shall celebrate the festival, and then in other places it says 7 days you shall celebrate the festival. Well, you know what? All of those discrepancies are dealt with in the oral tradition and explained, you know, as they are. And I would submit to you anyway, this is just my own little editorial comment, that those who believe that the Torah is not divine in origin, that it's a man-made document, well, you have to say that the editors were rather stupid or, like, short-sighted not to clear up obvious glaring discrepancies in the Torah. That's my only editorial comment. I should have shut it off for that. But in any case, the oral law deals with all of those discrepancies. There are phrases, every word of the Torah is, you know, yields different laws or, you know, details of the laws. Yeah, Ari.
You've spoken about different ambiguities and discrepancies in the law.
Yeah.
But then, I guess my question goes more towards, like, bright line rules and whether they're followed or not. Specifically, and I actually had this conversation with Jack in relation to the, I guess, the hierarchy within the Jewish people of Israelites, Levim, and Kohanim.
Okay.
Specifically, how, you know, God, you know, picked Aaron and his sons to be Kohanim, to be those priests within Israeli society. But yet, to the best of my knowledge, and I could be completely wrong on this, Rashi was not a Kohen.
Oh, sure. Okay, no, no.
So my question is...
No, no, can I say, jump in for a second? The Kohanim, the tribe of Levi... Okay, well, I mean, that's in... No, right, the Kohanim, everyone knows the word Kohen, right? They were the group from within the Jewish people, and more specifically from within the tribe of Levi, Levi being one of the sons of Jacob. They were the ones chosen to minister in the temple, first in the tabernacle, then in the temple. Okay, even though in early times, the tribe of Levi, in general, served as, quote, teachers of the Jewish people, scholarship and the passing on of the oral tradition and scholarship was not limited to the tribe of Levi or the Kohens. They had special duties.
Isn't that a bright line rule? I mean, here God specifically called Aaron and his sons.
To minister in the temple.
Correct. So then, what is that?
But ministering in the temple didn't involve being chiefly. Again, it didn't involve chiefly being the transmitters of Torah knowledge. In fact, our sages say that the tribe of Yisachar, one of the other sons of Jacob, they were the ones sitting in yeshiva, so to speak, day and night studying Torah. Not Levi. Levi was in the temple. I mean,
how can you go about administering something if you're not? Don't have the final say.
Oh, great. Good question. That's an amazing thing about Jewish life. You know where the Supreme Court of the Jewish people, the Sanhedrin, sat? On the Temple Mount. The 71 greatest sages, we'll talk about that maybe later, but the Supreme Court of the Jewish people, the final word in adjudicating Jewish law until the 2nd century CE, basically, sat... Well, I mean, when the temple was built, there was judges before, but it's such a general overview, obviously. But for 1,500 years, they sat right next to the Temple Mount so that any disputes that arose with regard to the temple service itself, they could be answered very quickly from this.
What type of legitimacy did they have?
Okay, great, okay.
If God didn't accept, and once again, at least looking at a bright line rule, God picked Aaron and his son.
To do what? What's a Kohen?
If you go
into
modern Hebrew, like a hen, you know,
it's a bee. Oh, good. Okay, good. But wait. I don't mean, you know, we'll come back to it in a second, but I want to just stress you. I don't want to make it sound like they say, our sages say in the oral tradition, that when the Jewish people were in Egypt, indeed, the tribe of Levi functioned as the teachers of the traditions par excellence for the whole Jewish people, who were, in fact, they weren't enslaved by Pharaoh, the tribe of Levi, the oral tradition says. But I just want to say, Ari, it wasn't that way that the Levites did not equal the great Torah scholars or even the Sanhedrin. So I'm saying, so like they had a certain, you know, they were chosen based on Aaron's and his sons, historic evidence of their zrizut, of their alacrity in fulfilling God's commandment, to carry on the service, so to speak, of, you know, the sacrificial service in the temple. But it wasn't. I'm not like John Roberts. I don't have the vocabulary of John Roberts. It wasn't coextensive or whatever with scholarship of the Torah. So hold on, maybe I'm not being clear. We'll talk more about that later or whatever. The Kohanim didn't set what was Torah law. The Sanhedrin did. Sanhedrin, there might have been Kohanim on it, but it wasn't all Kohanim. It was 71 sages. Rashi, you're quite right. Well, I'll tell you a funny little story. I mean, it's just a little anecdote, right? Thank God I have 4 children, and I'm not a Kohen. How many people here are, if they know, Kohanim? Okay, that's why you're bothered. Hey, we defer to you in everything, buddy, so don't get upset. No, we don't defer to you in Torah scholarship, if you don't, you know, but necessarily. But so my kids sometimes say, you know, like, because they have their friends in school, and they're Kohanim. But I wish we were a Kohanim, and, you know, like, you've probably even heard the famous joke, everyone's heard that old joke, right, about... Actually, I'll say it's a very cute joke. I'm not great at telling jokes, but the guy comes to the rabbi, and the guy says, wait, how does it go again? The guy says, Rabbi, wait, hold on. You remember the joke, Josh? Tell the joke.
Joel.
Whatever, the guy, remember the joke about the becoming a Kohen?
Yeah, I mean, the guy goes to rabbi and says, what do I have to do to become a Kohen?
Right.
Says,
I can't read, right.
I can't do anything. How much do I have to donate? I'll give you $1,000. I can't do anything. How much? $100,000. I'm sorry, I can't do anything. I'll give you my entire family's fortune, $10 million, whatever. Rabbi says, I have to ask you, you know, this is very tempting to me, but why do you want to be a Kohen? My father was a Kohen, my grandfather was a Kohen.
What do I have to do being a Kohen? Right. Okay, good. Very good, Joel. Nicely told. Okay. So my kids also are like, why can't we be Kohen? I say, you know, whatever. I say, this great rabbi, that great rabbi, they weren't Kohens. This righteous person wasn't a Kohen or daughter of a Kohen. I mean, you know, it's it's true that it was a, you know, I don't even want to say aristocracy. It really wasn't. I mean, traditional Judaism has certain distinctions within the population. For instance, a king of Israel had certain commandments that no other man or woman had, only the king. The Kohanim had certain mitzvot that only the Kohanim had. You know what I'm saying? So it wasn't like, yeah.
Manifestation on the part of the Sanhedrin trying to make a more, I guess, egalitarian, if that's even a word.
Well, I don't know. The Sanhedrin never challenged the idea of the Kohanim. I mean, that was part of the Torah, that there would be a... You know, in the written Torah itself, it's listed quite specifically all the privileges that the Kohanim will get and their duties in the Jewish people. So, and the Sanhedrin upheld that. I mean, they weren't, you know... Maybe wait a second. We'll maybe talk more about that. And certainly it's definitely true that, you know, many people probably know that around the time preceding the destruction of the Second Temple, talking the first century, there was a lot of corruption within the ranks of the Kohanim, because people paid off Roman authorities before that, Greek authorities, to get appointed as Kohen. So, I mean, that's another story, but it wasn't like the Kohanim, all or people who served as Kohanim, always were the exemplars of righteousness and piety or whatever. In earlier times, they were more, but, you know, there was corruption that crept into that system, which is why later in Jewish history there was kind of a split between the people. For instance, the Sadducees, many of the, what are called the Sadducees, were linked to some of the famous families of Kohanim who weren't so righteous, but you know, got appointed high priest or whatever. Anyway, so.
Right, but how did you get appointed to be on the Sanhedrin? It was by your peers.
Okay, that's absolutely very good point. That's a very good point, Joel. And that is, I mean, we'll talk about that later. That's true. Like a lot of things, that's true. There wasn't any election process. It was sort of by common consent, I guess. That's a good question. I mean, the exact procedural way, I'm not positive of that. I mean, but you know, there were lower courts, so there were lower Sanhedrins or whatever, 23 members and courts of three. That's a good question, like, you know, how it worked in practice. But I'll just say that, you know, by common consent and by common acceptance, like even today we don't have a Sanhedrin. It's a big problem in Jewish. In fact, one of the great difficulties with being Jewish people who follow the Torah, try to follow the Torah in our day and age, so to speak, is that, you know, we don't have any centralized Supreme Court of the Jewish people like we had in ancient times, the Sanhedrin. But in every generation, by common consensus, the greatest Torah scholars, at least I can only speak from a traditional perspective, they're universally recognized as what are called Gedolei Hador, the great rabbis of the generation. Rav Moshe Feinstein, who died about 20 years ago, had no title. He actually was the head of a yeshiva, small yeshiva in Lower East Side. But he had no title. He was not elected by his peers, but he was the Gedolei Hador. He knew Jewish law. He'd been through the Talmud 200 times in his lifetime. Knew it by heart, I'm sure. And he, every person, now, not that there weren't other great authorities of Jewish law, but he was the Gadol Hador. So I know I'm oversimplifying, but like, by common consensus, those who were the leaders of the academies or whatever, you know, it's a good question to look into more. That, yeah. I want to go further. I'm sorry, Yari, but yeah.
The Sanhedrin, you know, in terms of settling disputes, they were constantly revisiting, I guess, prior decisions.
No, not really. Not really. No, because part of the oral law was you couldn't overturn an earlier Sanhedrin's decision, except under very limited guidelines. That was part of the oral law.
If that's the case, then why the need on the part of Orthodoxy to, like, take the Shulchan Aruch and say, like...
Hold on a second. Many people might not even know what those terms are, but we'll get to that. I promise, we really will. Okay, so let's go further now. I've at least introduced the idea of an oral law, an oral tradition, elucidating, expounding. To cut to the chase a little bit, but we'll go through some processes here. Basically, what we're going to get to, the Talmud. What is the Talmud? Ultimately, it's a written down version of the oral tradition. That's what it is. Okay? At a certain time in history, it was written down under certain circumstances, which we'll talk about in a second. But just so you know, when we say Talmud, even though now there are books of Talmud, this is the first tractate of Talmud Bavli, the Babylonian Talmud, dealing with laws of blessings in prayer and food and different things like that. But essentially, this is the Oral Torah. Talmud and its commentaries and its discussion is the Oral Torah. And anyone knows, if you step into a traditional house of Jewish learning, a yeshiva, it's as all as can be. A Jewish library of learning is not quiet. People study and study partners, and it's oral. They say the words of the Talmud, they argue them, they debate them, they understand them. It's an oral law, still an oral law, really is. But it was written down at a certain point in history for certain reasons, which we want to talk about as well. Okay, let's read together if we could. This is from Maimonides. Everyone's heard one of the great pillars of Jewish law and learning and of medicine in the Middle Ages, or pre-Middle Ages, I guess, was Moses Maimonides, the Rambam, as he's called. The Rambam wrote many, many works, several works that are immortal, that non-Jewish people and Jewish people every day of every year study. More in the Guide to the Perplexed in philosophy, his Mishnah Torah, his compendium of Jewish law. Maybe another class we'll talk about a wonderful life he led as well. But he has one of the most masterful introductions to the oral law, in the introduction to the Mishnah, as it's called. So it's not his own ideas. Everything he wrote was just based on the Talmud and the other oral teachings. But let's just read what he said. It might sound strange, or it's a traditional view he's articulating, but let's read it together, and it'll give us an insight into, you know, his understanding and the Talmud's understanding of how in the early generations, the generation of Moses, that goes back to 1313 BCE is the traditional year and traditional dating that we say was the revelation of Mount Sinai, 1313 BCE. So what's that? What are we in now? Jackie, 2005, so that's 3,300 years ago? Okay. So let's read. Who wants to read? Robbie, would you read the first generation? What's that? Oh, sorry, Pete, the first part of the outline. We haven't gotten very far. B, the first generation.
Every mitzvah, the Holy One, blessed is he, gave to Moshe Rabbeinu, was given to him together with an explanation. Hashem would tell Moshe a verse in Torah, and then he would give to him his explanation, his underlying principles, and all the cases to which the verse applies. Moshe, in person, taught each verse of the Torah to the assembly of the children of Israel in the presence of Aharon and the elders.
And by the way, the written Torah says many times, specifically, Moshe gathered the whole assembly, not every section, but that's what they were doing for 40 years in the desert. They weren't playing Nintendo, obviously. They were studying the law. And complaining as well. They were complaining, right. Being Jewish people, they complained. Okay, keep going.
Afterwards, the people reviewed with one another what they had heard from Moshe and wrote down the verse on scrolls. Supervisors would visit the people to teach and review the verse until everyone knew it accurately and was well-versed in it. They then taught the people the explanation of the God given mitzvah and all its many details. Thus, the wording of the mitzvah would be recorded in writing, while oral tradition would be learned by heart.
Now, all these topics are dealt with more detail, whatever, but so it would be like this. It would be, hi, everybody, what is it? Get up. We had breakfast. We had the manna. Delicious breakfast. Had a cup of coffee. We made it taste like you could think, actually, as sages say, if you thought of a certain food, the manna would taste like it, so I would have made my manna taste like latte, double latte. So we sit down, and Moshe comes, or whatever, those who are interested in learning, and says, the verse says, Lo sevasho gedi bechalavimo. Don't boil a gedi, a young kid, in its mother's milk. Rabbi, Moshe, just a kid? No, the Torah means any kosher animal. It uses the example of a kid, because we know kid tastes delicious in milk, don't we, or whatever. How old is the kid? Talk all the details of the mitzvah, without which, it doesn't make sense how to live by such a verse or what it means. I'll give you a more classic example and a more fundamental example, right? 6 days you shall work. But on the Sabbath day, you shall do no malacha. You shall do no work. What does that mean? What does the word malacha mean? Why doesn't the Torah use it? The more simple word for work is avodah. Avodah means kind of like the work and toil you do usually. It says malacha. What does the word malacha mean? All of the guidelines for what it means to not do work on the Sabbath, which is repeated many times in the Torah, which is a capital punishment in Jewish law if you violate it, it would beg out, we need some elucidation on what it means work. I once had a rabbi that was very funny. He said, that means if I'm a professional comedian, I can't tell a joke at my Shabbos table? I would have got stoned. Does that work? He was just being facetious. But the idea being, all of that was part of the oral communication. What is malacha? What kind of activities are included in malacha in work? That's what... But the wording was precise. The wording was precise. 6 days you shall work, on the seventh you shall not work. But the oral explanation, which could have gone on for a year, there's a whole tractate of the Talmud about the laws of the Sabbath. Whatever, I mean, it could have gone on for a year, obviously, to master that. Okay. Yeah, sure, but I want to say one other thing, yes. Well, very good. It's actually, so you're a very good point. Malacha, which is the word which is really better translated as creative activity, closer than what we think of as work, because, you know, you can, if your wife tells you to move furniture all day in your house on the Sabbath, you're not violating the Sabbath. But if you, in Jewish law, you know, write one letter, that's malacha, or whatever. Write one, you know. So it's creative activity as defined by the oral tradition. But that's a good question, Jackie's saying. It is the same letter as Mem, Lamed, Chaf, Hey. At least that's three of the letters of Melech, of a king. But it's also Malach, an angel. So I'm not sure what the answer is. I'm not sure. I'm sure there's some conceptual connection. I have no doubt about that. On one foot, maybe it's because the king is really supposed to embody the, you know, I don't know, creative collective activity of the people. I mean, I'm not sure. I'm just throwing out an idea. You know, who knows why? It's a good point, though. But see, you might say Rabbi, but so, or, you know, so okay. So the oral tradition sounds like it's really the, it's kind of like the fleshed out version. Why do you even need the written verses? Aha. So here's a very beautiful and important insight. And we really could have a whole class on why an oral law? Why not write everything down, which we'll talk about in a second. But a very great rabbi in the 19th century, Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch, a very great thinker in the Jewish world, German rabbi, he described it, and I think a very memorable way, and as students you'll appreciate it. He said the relationship of the written Torah to the oral Torah is like, he didn't say cliff notes. It's like shorthand notes on the master lecture given by the professor. You don't have time to write down everything, and you can't write down every case the professor talks about in his master lecture, but you take in shorthand, and you review it enough so that anytime you read the shorthand notes, you can call to mind all the other relevant cases or whatever. That's the relationship, very beautifully put, between the written Torah and the oral Torah. So the writing of it was very important. Why? Because it would jog your memory, the wording of it or whatever, or at least it would keep the basic idea from being forgotten. And enough of it would come to mind again, and then we'll talk more about this idea, but, you know, so that it would call to mind the rest of the teachings of that verse or of that law. Okay. Any questions about that? Well, let me jump in and anticipate one question about that. Rabbi, come on. Oral traditions, we all know that oral traditions are very unreliable, right? They're very, we've all played telephone in grade school where the teacher says, you know, I have a lunchbox to one kid, and by the end of it, it's like, you know, my socks are crunchy or whatever. It's a different message at the end of the transmission. Come on, Rabbi. You expect me to believe that there was a faithful transmission of the oral law? Telephone's a very bad analogy for this. Why? A lot of reasons why. Number one, telephone has how many lines of transmission? One. The oral law for generations, every head of the household, every head of every school had hundreds and thousands of students learning the oral law. In other words, it was a built-in corrective mechanism. Right? At this school, I heard the explanation that way, but every other one in the town heard the explanation the other way. You're wrong. You heard it wrong. And that, now, I'm not saying it was a foolproof guarantee, but it was one of the ways that it's not a good analogy, I'm sorry, to think of it as telephone. There were literally thousands in every generation of lines of transmission. Self-correcting mechanism. Number two, if you think of it that way, telephone is nonsense. I have a lunchbox is not life or death information. The Torah is life or death. It's always was looked at by our people. These are the days of your life. This is the essence of who you are in this world, in the world to come. It was life or death, and that's how Jewish diligence was always based on the idea that this is a law that we're supposed to carry out to be a light unto the nations and all the other beautiful things that we're supposed to be in this world through keeping and studying the Torah. So it wasn't exactly like telephone. I think a better example, I thought of this example, but like, you know, maybe I heard it from some other rabbi probably. You know, if you're in a submarine, right? And the rabbi says, you know what, I misplaced the pencils and papers, guys, I'm sorry, but come around to the hatch here. I'm going to tell you something very important about the mechanism to keep this hatch closed. You're going to not leave that little lecture till you've got it down, till you've memorized it 100 times. That's what Jewish learning was. The Talmud says, without any hyperbole, that the great sages would review their lesson 101 times. Let me get a little hyper. I don't know. I don't think it was hyperbole. But anyway, they review it over and over. We all know the Shema. Many of us do know the Shema, the watchword of our faith. It's from the book of Deuteronomy, that first paragraph. We say, Vishinan tam livanecha vidibarta bam. And you will literally teach them to your children and speak in them, in words of Torah and of the unity of God, which it's talking about there. But Rashi says a beautiful comment. Vishinan tam, that doesn't mean to teach. Shimin is not the word for teach. That's you. Hora is the word for teach. Vishinan tam is related to the word to sharpen, like to sharpen a knife. So the oral tradition says the Torah uses that word, vishinantam, because the words should be sharp in your mouth, like, you know, like you learn them. I don't know the exact language Rashi says. So that you can answer sharply on any point of the Torah. And that's, and I'm far from that level, believe me. But that was the level of the people who transmitted the oral law generation to generation, vishinantam levanecha. Sharp is, they had a thing in the yeshivas, in the great Talmudic academies in Europe, even into our generation, I mean, displaced to America, or transplanted, I should say, to America, called the pin test. I only like telling these stories just to, you know, because these are the people, the gedolim, these people unimaginably great in learning and wisdom. The pin test was where the greatest scholars in the yeshiva or in the generation, they did. You could take a pin and stick it through a volume of the Talmud, and the Torah scholar could tell you on every page of that tractate what word was right under the pin. Because they not only knew the words of the Talmud, but they knew every page of the Talmud. Every page is shaped a little bit differently, and they knew it backwards and forwards. I mean, that was, you know, not everyone is like that in every generation, of course not. But, like, those were the ones who were the key links in the chain of transmission. Now, who are they? Let's keep reading a little bit more. Farva, would you mind reading, passing down that tradition? Thank you for coming. I'm sorry. It's come back next time. Email me, buy me coffee, something. Okay, yeah. Barbara, would you read, this is passing down the tradition. The first paragraph is from a bit of the Mishnah, which is the outline of what later became the Talmud. And at one tractate, one section of the Mishnah, it gives you a little overview of this transmission process. Barbara, Moshe received the
Torah from Sinai and transmitted it to Joshua. Yahushua to the elders to the prophets, and the prophets transmitted it to the men of the great assembly.
Who lived around 340 BCE. That was the name of the Sanhedrin and other sages at the time that Ezra, who we probably heard of, Ezra lived at the beginning of the Second Temple period when Jewish people came back, some of them, not all, from Babylon, from Iraq, that's where Babel was, came back after the First Temple was destroyed, come back to rebuild the Second Temple, and the great assembly was the Sanhedrin and other sages who really put Judaism on. The Judaism we know today, a lot of it comes from the institutions that the great assembly, like making blessings before food. Many of the rabbinical commandments come from the era of the great assembly. I'm sorry, keep going. Okay, yeah, stop there. I just want to show you the transmission. You read very nicely. I'm not, you know. Moses to Joshua. Joshua to the elders, to the prophets. The names of those people are in the books of what is called the Tanakh, the Jewish prophets. Whether it's Samuel the prophet or King David, that was part of a line of transmission in every generation. Now, let's read the next thing, and then I want to show you an amazing point. And we really will get to, you know, we're going to get to the Talmud, don't worry. We're not going to do every little thing here in the outline here. Actually, Barbara, keep going. Because keep reading where we were, because this is still Maimonides' writing. Because it is hard to understand how you get from, you know, a very abbreviated verse in the Torah, not how you get to it. Like I said, there was oral explanation that surrounded it, but like just how it worked as years went on, as Jewish life became more complicated, societally or whatever. Like, how is this Torah still guiding us in its rules? So keep reading. It's
They, the men of the great assembly, said three things. Be deliberate in judgment, raise up many disciples, and make a fence for the Torah.
Okay, good. I want you to skip down to the next thing, but raise up many disciples. Every Torah teacher was called upon to have many students of Torah, so that the Torah would not be forgotten.
After Moshe died, Yehoshua and the sages of his time studied and researched the explanations they received from Moshe. no question or dispute arose regarding any matter that Yehoshua or any of the elders had explicitly heard from Moshe himself.
In other words, in the early times, tradition teaches, there were no huge disagreements at all in the basics of Jewish law. And were there disagreements, there was some centralized body of sages, what later became, it's already mentioned in the book of Deuteronomy, the Sanhedrin, the supreme court of the Jewish people, so that discrepancies in the oral transmission would get worked out and ultimately decided by the sages. When the Sanhedrin actually sat as a formal court, a majority rule would prevail. So if someone said, you know what? And later on in our history, there was some forgetting of certain details of the laws that would be worked out, as we'll see in a second, either by certain interpretive rules given, handed down, or by the vote of the Supreme Court of the Jewish people. Okay, keep going.
However, related cases for which Moshe had not given specific instruction were solved by applying the 13 rules of interpretation by means of which the Torah is expounded, rules that were given on Sinai.
Hold off, Barbara. So, I think even Alan sort of almost alluded to it in a sense. When you said that the oral law is, in a sense, a key, which I think is a good point, to the written Torah, the oral law itself has provided with it keys for unlocking or expanding within boundaries laws of the Torah. What do I mean, 13? In other words, when you study Talmud, which God willing, maybe we'll actually look at a piece, I hope, next time or whatever, but like many of the extensions, not inventions, but many of the applications of Torah law are derived from using certain principles of analysis that the Talmudic sages use. Like what? Like the same word in two verses, called a Gezerah Shavah. If two words are in the same verse, it means God's telling us there's a conceptual link between the two verses. Okay, whatever. The most famous articulation of these principles of analysis were called the 13 rules of interpretation. You know, I meant to copy it for you. Most traditional prayer books have them in the morning service. Some people actually say them as part of their morning prayer service. They're like, you know, based on word order or word construction in a verse, they were ways that, again, from the written law itself could come the branching out of all the cases that would have to be decided in the oral, in a society, right? In a functioning society that's meant to be governed by Torah law. Some of the laws derived this way were undisputed and were unanimously agreed upon. Other laws gave rise to controversy based on differences in the logical reasoning of different sages. Again, not the one, the obvious meaning, right? The verse says, thou shalt not kill, right? Everyone knows going after someone and killing them is against the Torah, right? And against common morality. But what about all these other different things? Is that called killing? Is that called killing? That was all part of the oral tradition, either explicitly given from Moses or meant for the sages to develop, not invent, with the help of the 13 rules. Now, that's a very beautiful idea. You probably have heard the concept, which I think is a very great conceptual, philosophical idea, that Judaism is about a partnership of man and God in creation. Probably heard that phrase, maybe. It's really true. Just like God, and the world itself, right? Bread does not grow on trees. Mankind was given wheat, and we learned or were taught to make it into bread. So too the law. The law was given at Sinai, and our tradition says Moshe knew the whole Torah, both the oral, even the oral explanations he was shown that would be derived in the future. But each generation, to some extent, has the responsibility to use their own minds to apply, not to invent, the Torah in that, generation. Okay, so, but when such disputes arose, they would follow the majority opinion as it's stated in Exodus. A case must be decided on the basis of the majority. Okay. Okay, skip ahead. From the time of the Great Assembly, really the whole Second Temple period, and we're not going to do too much history, but Second Temple period starting around 350 BCE all the way till 70 or 69 AD or CE, right? 400 years roughly, the Second Temple stood in Jerusalem. Our whole existence as a people was very different in the Second Temple period than the First Temple period. Much, much more civil unrest, much more growing persecution, certainly when the Romans come on the scene, even the Hanukkah story, right? The Hanukkah story is really the beginning of what you call, and I think it's fair to say, around the time of the Hanukkah story, the Hasmonean revolt, against the Greeks or the Syrian Greeks. That's the time in this transmission of law where more disagreements begin to arise, more discrepancies. Ultimately, if you know the Talmud, if you've heard, it even came to there a few hundred disagreements between the school of Hillel and the school of Shammai. Actually, Hillel lived about 100 years after the Hanukkah story, but it already in that time, my point is, the level of disruption to Jewish life was much greater in the Second Temple than in the First Temple period. Much greater. Why? Due to the kingdoms, either the Greek kingdom or then the Roman kingdom, due to many things, persecutions when the Romans come to power, and therefore there was, you might call it what's called machloket, a growing, now again, the disagreements were not about, hey, are we allowed to eat milk and meat together? I think we are. No, I think we're not. I mean, I'm being facetious, but like, people don't understand, Talmudic disagreements are about the application of a body of law that was universally agreed upon, right? And I'm not saying that's trivial in the Talmud or in the oral law, but the disagreements were about details of carrying out the mitzvot. Still important, but like everyone realized, keep Shabbat, you know, don't do malacha on Shabbat. It was about, you know, what was the first dispute? I mean, not unimportant, but the first dispute that arose between, I think, the school of Hillel and the school of Shammai had to do with leaning your hands on an animal when you're bringing it as a sacrifice on a Jewish festival. Okay, because there's certain issues in making use of an animal or an animal's labor on the festival, whatever. So, I mean, it's important, but it's in detail of a law of bringing a sacrifice to God or whatever. In these years, certainly with Hillel lived around, I wrote it down, I'm sorry. Hillel was the, 32 BCE was when he was the president, he was the leader of the sages in Israel, fine. But this is a period where due to persecution, due to dislocation, and remember, some Jews had not come back from Babylon, and actually academies of Jewish learning were established there, but it was much less settled existence, more disputes in the transmission of the oral law. And basically, to skip ahead, go to the next page where it says Rabbi Judah the Prince. We're skipping way ahead, but it's important. We're skipping ahead, but basically, there came a time when an emergency measure was taken with the greatest amount of forethought and consultation with others. Rabbi Judah the Prince, in the first century, 130 CE or so, he was the leading sage, a descendant of King David and of Hillel, decided that, in consultation with the other Jewish sages at the time, that there had to be a more organized, written-down version of the oral law, or it could well be forgotten in the persecutions present and to come. When I say in a more organized form, because there's another point to remember, an oral law doesn't mean that teachers didn't have written notes. Of course they did. They had their own notes and scrolls of their own interpretations or what they heard from their rabbis. But a book, meaning a book to be published as this is Torah Shabbat Al-Peh, the oral law, that we were not supposed to do. It was meant to be oral and not written down. But as an emergency measure, Rav Yehuda HaNasi, in consultation with the sages, decided, as they say, it's a verse in the it was a time to fight on behalf of God or the whole Torah would be forgotten. And therefore, he gathered for decades all the oral traditions that he knew by heart and that many knew by heart. They memorized the oral traditions, but he gathered them together and didn't write himself, but organized and edited a written body of work that then became known as Mishnah. And Mishnah is the outline form. It is only an outline of the basic precepts of Jewish law of the oral tradition. Okay, now, when I say outline, I mean no explanation. What's the blessing you make when you eat an apple? Rabbi Yossi says, Borei Priya Eitz. Rabbi Yehuda says, Borei Pri Hadama. The Mishnah, Rabbi Judah the Prince, made sure to include disputed opinions in the Mishnah, and even opinions that were not followed as the practical halakha, Jewish law. Why? Because he always intended it to remain Torah Shabbat Peh, oral. You weren't going to be able to read the Mishnah and know it all from the Mishnah. You'd have to study to understand the Mishnah. But you could memorize the Mishnah relatively quickly. 5 years of study, I don't know, right? The Mishnah is still a big book. But you can memorize it, and therefore the outline by Mishnah, the outline of the oral law would not be forgotten. Couldn't tell the final decision from the Mishnah. Why? That wasn't an omission. It was on purpose. God, traditionally we understand, wanted it to be an oral law. An oral law is a living law. It's not some book on a shelf that you look to only when you want the answer. Oral law is about understanding the mechanism, the application, whatever. So it was a brief outline form. That was written down, finally, I mean, give or take, around the year 200 CE. That's 150 years after the destruction of the Second Temple. That's when there's a fully edited form of what's called Mishnah. The word Mishnah is like from the word to repeat, because it was meant to be repeated, and in fact it was memorized. Now, how big is the Mishnah? What's the Mishnah? And really, we'll get to the Talmud, we really will, in 10 minutes, but the Mishnah covers, look back here. And really, the Mishnah is the building blocks of what's called the Talmud. Before the Ezra, look on this page here. Six orders of the Mishnah, meaning six broad subject areas of the oral law, as written down in the Mishnah. Each one's called a Seder, an order. And then you'll see under that the individual books, or what's called tractates of the Mishnah, dealing basically with that topic. Seder's Rayim, agricultural laws. A lot of them don't apply outside the land of Israel, some do. Seder Moed, all the laws of the festival. Shabbat, Yom Kippur, Sukkot, all of those are tractates of one order or one section of Mishnah. Seder Nashim, laws having to do with men and women, marriage, divorce, the ketubah, different things like that. Four, what most of your time, probably a lot of it is in law school, mezikin, damages, torts, civil cases, civil law. Five, kadshim, that deals almost wholly with sacrificial matters of offerings in the temple, although the laws of kashrut, of keeping kosher, are in that section of Mishnah. And Seder Tarot, the hardest in many ways, the most abstract, sections dealing with ritual purity, most of which are only related to the temple times. Six orders of Mishnah, 63 or 61, depending on how you count, individual books or tractates within the Mishnah. It was still designed to be and was memorized. An amazing thing. When we think of, everyone knows that anyway, that modern man, us, we're so smart, we have our iPods, we have everything, we don't use our brains in terms of even memorization like earlier generations did. And people memorize more, even just in school kids. My mother, right, had to memorize so much poetry. No teacher when I had high school ever asked me to memorize a poem. My mother can still, who's 73, she should live long, still can say Tennyson's poems and Kipling's poems. I was never told, and I was an English major, I was never told to memorize a poem. So memorization was certainly a part of Jewish tradition and learning. But what's a book of Mishnah look like? Well, here's a book of Mishnah, just one book of Mishnah. Bava Metzia, it deals with, it's in Nezikin. It deals with laws of ownership, lost articles, a disputed case. It starts off with a famous case that little kids study in a yeshiva, one of the first things they study. Shnayim Ochsin Batalit. Two people come into the court, a rabbinic court, each one holding a garment, and each one says, I got to it first, I picked it up first off the ground, it's mine. But this whole tractate deals with laws of ownership and possession. But I just want to show you, Mishnah is really just, it's little paragraphs and nuggets of law. Ignore the side, because that's a later commentary on the Mishnah. But it's just like paragraphs of case law, you might call it, with just the bare bones of the law. So in any one book of Mishnah, this particular tractate has 10 chapters. Each chapter has like 8 to 10 paragraphs of law, so to speak. Okay, fine. Jumping ahead. After Judah the Prince organized this body of material, and by the way, I want to say another thing, it was written in a way that made it easier to memorize, meaning you could study Mishnah sometimes, and in the middle of the tractate that deals with like property law, suddenly they'll have a teaching about divorce. And the only reason it's there is because the word structure is very similar, and therefore with Judah the Prince, even at the cost of sometimes diverging from the topic of the tractate, would insert another Mishnah because it was worded a similar way. Why? To memorize more easily. So you have a whole chapter of a tractate where it just goes off on different topics because the wording is similar. I'll give you an example. Like you could, what am I talking about? Like you could have, let's just say hypothetically, in one tractate, it'll say there are four criteria for determining if an article is ownerless. Let's just say I'm making one up. And then the Mishnah will have other Mishnahs from other parts of the oral law where there are four criteria. So I'll say there are four criteria to make a ketubah kosher. There are four criteria by which a man can take a hand of a woman in marriage or whatever it is. And that was always done. That shows unmistakably the oral nature of this tradition. It was still, even when written down, kept with an idea for easy memorization. They're also mnemonic devices. The sages would summarize a whole tractate of Mishnah on, like, almost nonsense words, like abkadapweh, based on the first letter of the Mishnah, or whatever, to help them memorize. Okay, Talmud. We still have a few minutes. What's the Talmud? To put it simply, for 300 years or so, 200 years, the Mishnah was the main text of study in the academies of Jewish law. It wasn't the only text, right? Because there were other collections of similar legal material that, so to speak, didn't make its way into the Mishnah. But the Mishnah was the most authoritative, accepted by all the sages of the time as the definitive collection's not the right word, statement of the oral law. Judah the prince, who redacted the Mishnah, left out on purpose certain things he thought were tangential, but it doesn't mean that the sages weren't aware of those. There were other collections. In fact, many of them were his students, who made other collections that were not in the Mishnah of paragraphs of oral law, so to speak. But in the academies, the Mishnah was the main study or text they studied. A few hundred years later, let's put the clock a few hundred years later. Again, there was the feeling among a generation of sages or whatever that more was needed to be written down than just the Mishnah. The Mishnah itself, like I said, was the very tip of the iceberg. It doesn't explain a whole lot at all. It's just, he said this, he said this. That's mostly what the Mishnah is. Why did he say that? What does it mean, the word he uses? What cases does that apply in? That was all oral. But the Talmud then becomes, a few hundred years later, by the year 500 CE or so, let's say from the year 430 to 500, is when the further elucidation and explanation of the Mishnah is being written down. And, you know, there are certain names of great sages associated with the writing of the Talmud, of the Babylonian Talmud. Ravina, Rav Ashi, they were people who lived in Babylon and Bavel in the 400s and 500s. Basically, by the year 500, something called the Talmud is completed. The Talmud being the Mishnah and the analysis, or Gemara, it's called, the analysis of each paragraph of Mishnah. And that's the Talmud. Commentary in the sense of its received explanation in a more fleshed out form, the reasoning behind the law in the Mishnah, the tracing of the law in the Mishnah to the source in the written Torah. Because this oral law, like I said, I tried to show, is not separate from the written Torah. It's intimately and organically tied to the words of the written Torah. So a lot of the Talmud tries to pinpoint exactly where and in what words oral traditions are rooted in the written Torah. Contradictions, I mean, I'll tell you that in one second, an important point. But, so basically, now the Talmud, just quickly, So a page of Talmud, for instance, you could have one paragraph of Mishnah, and then ignore the things on the sides. Those are later commentaries, but don't ignore, learn them, but not now, right? You have a paragraph of Mishnah, and then you could have five pages, the middle column, of discussion of the Mishnah. Why? Because, I'll give you an example, this is the first Mishnah of the whole Mishnah. What does it say? From what time do we begin reciting the evening Shema? Meaning, the Torah says, you shall recite these words when you lie down and when you get up. What does it mean when you lie down? Well, the oral tradition always taught it means nighttime. How do we define nighttime? That's the first Mishnah in the whole Talmud. And there are many pages of discussion of when exactly is nighttime. And, you know, it's very interesting, actually. I mean, but, you know, it's the technical matters of whatever. But it could be many, many, many pages of Gemara, as it was called, the reasoning behind the Mishnah. Just there was an earlier written down of these explanations of the Mishnah done in the Holy Land itself. That's called the Jerusalem Talmud, the Talmud Yerushalmi. Scholars, great scholars, still study it today, but it was never accepted as authoritative as the Babylonian Talmud. Why? The Babylonian Talmud came later. The sages who put together the Babylonian Talmud understood already the decisions of the sages. There was a lot of communication between Jerusalem and places in Israel and Babel, back and forth all the time. So the later Talmud, the Talmud that's studied universally in academies of Jewish learning today, is the Talmud Bavli, the Babylonian Talmud. It's more fleshed out. It takes into account the earlier decisions of the sages in Israel, etc., etc. So it's truthfully, Talmud can mean the Jerusalem Talmud or the Babylonian Talmud, but in 99% of the cases, people mean the Babylonian Talmud. The Babylonian Talmud has, it's not every tractate of Mishnah, I'm sorry, it's so technical, every tractate of Mishnah, Ravina and Ravashi and the great sages did not write down the discussion. In other words, they didn't make Talmud out of every tractate of Mishnah. 37 of the 63 tractates became Talmud. Why did they do that? It's a good question. It wasn't an omission. They decided that especially the two sections of Mishnah that deal with laws of purity, Taharos, as it's called, and Zroyim, laws of agriculture, they interspersed that material among all the other sections of the Gemara, the Talmud, but they didn't write them down as separate volumes. Many say because they feared that these matters were so technical and could be so dry that people wouldn't study them on their own, and therefore they intersperse. You could have a whole section of, let's say, for instance, a Talmud dealing with laws of marriage. Like I said, there'll be a 5-page diversion, somewhat, on laws of ritual purity. Whatever it is. So we don't have, just so you're not confused, why are there not 63 tractates of Babylonian Talmud? There are 37. But so it wasn't on every single section of Mishnah that they wrote down the discussions, what's called the Talmud. Now, the Talmud is not the final story either. We have to stop in a couple of minutes, obviously, but the Talmud, traditionally understood, and here's where there are also different opinions among different Jews, right? In the traditional world, in the Orthodox world, the Talmud was accepted as authoritative in the sense that no one could come and openly say, I don't accept the conclusion of the Talmud. Why? It was accepted by all the sages of the time. It was. Not that the certain individual decisions couldn't be discussed or whatever, but the idea that the Talmud is somehow still like evolving is not a traditional view. Now, it doesn't mean Jewish law is a dead fossil. No, because you need a lot of wisdom to be able to, you have to apply Talmudic law to present day situation. So even after the Talmud in 500 CE, through every generation till the moment we're speaking now, there are great Torah sages applying Talmudic law and its post-Talmudic precedents to modern cases. I'll just give you one quick example. So you say, right? What does it say in the Talmud anything about deciding whether you can pull the plug on a terminally ill patient?